And the Zionist regime does not allow foreign journalists to enter Gaza and report on what they see freely either. CNN's Farid Zakaria recently admitted that the Israeli regime military currently only allows into the war-torn Gaza Strip foreign journalists who agree to submit all materials and footage to the Israeli military for review prior to publication. Zakaria said CNN agreed to these terms in order to provide a limited window to Israel's ops. Yet, despite all these efforts, thanks largely to social media, the Zionist regime is no longer able to conceal the truth about its conduct in Palestine. It can no longer control the narratives and the public opinion on Palestine. As mainstream media loses its ability to single-handedly decide what Western and, to a certain extent, global audiences get to witness about the situation in Palestine, the brutality of Israel's occupation has been laid out in the open for everyone to see. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we consider a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. As the world watches on in the face of Israel's genocidal onslaught against the people of Gaza, one consistent theme which has stood out has been the unbreakable spirit and faith of the Palestinian people. It has led Muslims to look for ways in which they can show their solidarity to the people of Gaza, turning to their religious leaders for guidance. However, when it comes to fulfilling those responsibilities, some Muslim preachers have fallen short, to say the least.
As Muslims look towards scholars, callers to Islam, and academics for guidance on how best to support the people of Palestine, some leaders have been exposed by either their silence or, worse yet, their outright treachery towards the people of Palestine. Take Asim al-Hakim, a Saudi-born Indonesian sheikh. When asked about the concept of Muslims boycotting pro-Israeli businesses, he discouraged the idea, saying that Muslims should leave other Muslims alone and not enjoin the good on them.
So this is a personal preference. If you want to boycott because you feel that it would hurt those who support Israel, good for you. This is your personal way of doing it. But if you see someone not doing it or consuming their cheeseburgers or fried chicken, you cannot blame them and say, oh, shame on you. You're drinking their soft drinks. No, it's not. It's halal.
Or Faraz Hamadi, a former fitness instructor turned social media influencer and preacher based in the USA, who says boycotting Israeli companies is haram unless a Muslim ruler approves it.
Hey, guys, everyone, we should boycott so-and-so company. I had a deal with that company. They're paying us. And when we have a deal together, you're ruining that deal. And it's up to the Muslim government that you cannot disobey it like that. If the Muslim government or the ruler says boycott, then yes. Because he knows things you don't know. And they have agreements, they have taken care of it. So now he says okay to boycott. And it happened before. But if it doesn't happen now, meaning that we don't know something. It's going to harm us if we boycott them. Yeah? So boycotting, that's why many of the ulama, they said boycotting is haram.
And finally, London-based Shamsi, a pro-Saudi Salafist preacher who appeared on a podcast with Faraz Hamadi, mocking those who have called for boycotting Starbucks in solidarity with the people of Gaza and deflecting with claims about social media links to Zionism.
There are, of course, big multi-million dollar companies like Starbucks and McDonald's and other kind of names.
Big you know, I love Starbucks, you know. People are driving me crazy, okay. Starbucks. I'm gonna hide it.
I don't drink Starbucks, by the way, but you're drinking Starbucks, right? Yeah. I saw some of your videos, you're holding the cup. I'm like, man, this guy's gonna get a lot of heat now.
You don't understand. You know, I'll tell you this funny story, yeah? Someone sent me a message on Instagram, and he said to me, Achi, do you know that Starbucks is a Zionist supporter? I said, okay. I said, do you know that Instagram, the owner of Instagram, is a Zionist supporter? Yeah.
These men and many other influencers like them belong to a wing of Salafism referred to sometimes disparagingly as Madhhalism. One core tenet is that Muslims must always obey their leaders, a concept that is generally accepted by some Muslims, but for those influencers, there don't appear to be any particular conditions as to when disobeying those rulers should be prioritized, such as when those leaders are collaborating with Israel.
Joining us today to talk these issues through are two esteemed guests and favorites of the show. With me in the studio is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who is one of our few honorable scholars that is unapologetic in his Islamic duty of condemning the oppression in Palestine. He graduated from the Islamic Seminary in Qom and lectures in the UK. And joining us on Skype is Brother Shakil Afsar from Birmingham. Shakil is a prominent Kashmiri activist who has tirelessly campaigned against Islamophobia in the UK and abroad, and has consistently championed the Palestinian cause in the mainstream. Thank you to you both for joining us. Sheikh, if I can come first and foremost to you, I don't know how you felt watching, you know, that VT. That was, it made me angry. But as a scholar, you know, what are the responsibilities of Muslim scholars in times of oppression? We saw that, masalan, these people were saying that we should avoid boycotting. You know, specifically, is that something that Muslim scholars have the right to say or do?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the time of oppression, in the time of the extremes of oppression, like what we are seeing in Gaza right now, the duty of Muslim scholars is to provide clarification, understanding to the people of why this is happening, what are the forces behind it, you know, who are on what side, and what role should we play in this. I think a lot of people tend to have a very limited idea of what the Muslim scholars who are the leaders of our society should do. They think that they should only be providing, spiritual services, but not be involved in the issues of community empowerment, consolidation, and guidance in terms of how to face the challenges that are presented to their societies. And this is one of the challenges that is being presented to our society, and we can judge them by their response.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. You know, judging these kind of scholars, just as we saw earlier, Shakil, if I can come to you, as we saw earlier in the show, you know, there are some Muslim scholars who have taken an approach that some would call disappointing, some would call treacherous. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. At a time when a lot of British Muslims don't actually know what to do and they're at wit's end, we have scholars saying that we shouldn't be boycotting. We have scholars saying that we should be listening to Muslim leaders. The question I have for these Muslim scholars, or so-called scholars, I would call them, is what are the Muslim leaders actually doing? Do they not see the videos that are coming out of Palestine? Do they not see the young innocent children? If British Kashmiris, American Kashmir Muslims, if Muslims all over the world want to boycott because they feel that is the only weapon they have, why are people pushing them away from this? Maybe those scholars are on the payroll of the oppressors. You know, a lot of times people will tell and misguide the community to serve their own pockets. And, you know, I firmly believe that people like these scholars who, for whatever reason, I'm not a scholar myself, and I have never, you know, claimed to be one. But what I do suggest is, why are these people pushing away, you know, people who stand by Palestinians from wanting to do something? You know, they're saying we must listen to the Muslim governments. But every single one of you can see, what are the Muslim governments really doing? We have Muslim superpowers who have nuclear power and they are sat on the fence. You know, I firmly believe at the end, when this is all said and done, we won't remember the oppression of our oppressors, but we will really remember the silence of our friends.
Really well said. You know, I remember reading a statistic to say that all the Muslim countries in the world, they occupy, you know, a sixth of the world's wealth, if not more. And they could not get a drop of water into Gaza. They have not yet done anything to actively, really, on the ground, make an impact on the genocide that's going on. And just as Shakil said, Sheikh, you know, some Muslim leaders are, or Muslim scholars, preachers, are actually thinking about their own pocket because they are getting some money for their stances, let's say. But religiously, and the question to you is, religiously, are there any justifications for Muslims to stay silent when it comes to oppression?
No, and I think that goes against the statement by the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, when he said, when a Muslim is confronted with a wrongdoing, he's a Muslim, he didn't say the Muslim ulama, okay? When they're confronted with a wrongdoing, they should change it with their hands. You know, meaning that if you have the power, for example, the political power, the economic power, you see, to be able to actively change that, then you should do that. And if you cannot do this, then you should speak out against it with your tongue. You know, and speaking out against it with our tongues include things like demonstrations, for example. You know, chants, slogans, analyses, historical approaches to these types of things. And if you cannot do this, which means that the situation is so repressive, you know, that just speaking out with the tongue is dangerous to you, can get you killed. You know, then you hate it in your heart, and hating that wrongdoing in your heart is the least of iman. In other words, if you had 1 ounce of iman, you know, you should be able to hate oppression. At any rate, at this point in time, we don't have that intense oppression over speech yet to say that we cannot speak out, you see? And so when people talk about, you know, only the scholars have the right to say this and the scholars have the right to say that, or the quote-unquote leaders, I don't know what they mean by this amorphous term, leaders, All right? What is this actually denying us is agency, you see, because that hadith, it applies to all Muslims, you know, not that, you know, you just have to follow your leader for you to decide to take action.
Yes, absolutely, Sheikh. And, you know, the Muhammadi spirit is clear. It encourages the good and forbids the evil. But some believe that this is a personal endeavor not to be mixed in with politics. We went to the streets of London to ask Muslims about what they expect from religious leadership during times of war, and in this case, genocide.
We need to see calls for action made against this vile, genocidal Israeli entity. So what we want to see from our speakers, we want to see calls for boycotting, we want to see pressure being put on these members of parliament, we want to see anything that can be done to aid our brothers and sisters in Gaza and Palestine. Anything that can be done, we want to see it being done. So anyone who has a voice and has been silent on this matter, just understand that the community is not going to forget this.
Whether like very political or like just, you know, the social media scholars as we know them, we've seen them there from the start. And then 7 October onwards, we saw them, you know, even come out more. And, you know, I think every day their stories, their feed is just about Palestine. And they've been teaching us how to talk more, how to advocate more, boycotting, the role of, like, you know, to keep this going, to keep talking about it.
I think, like, for example, the other day, Said Sistani put, I don't know if you saw it, on Karbala, on Imam al-Abbas' grave, alayhi salam, he put, like, a big poster that it's wajib to boycott and stuff. Like, as much as you can, because obviously you can never boycott everything, but as much as you can, you know, if you go to the supermarket, you see cola on the fridge, you don't buy it.
We should not stop. The protests should not stop. We should not stop speaking about it. Everyone that has a platform, you have 2 followers, 3 followers, 5 followers, everyone needs to speak, push it forward. You meet someone in a cafeteria, speak to them, see what they're saying, teach them. And another thing that I think is very important is when we are going to the protest, is that we understand, I'm talking especially to the Muslims, is for us to stick to the Quran and Sunnah and the Sharia. that we don't, you know, do things that go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told us to do.
Shaquille, if I can come to you in this question. In the West, many scholars have stayed silent. Do you think that this exposes where people's loyalties lie? You did, you know, briefly in your previous answer, talk about their pockets aligned. You know, can you go into a bit more detail about that?
Well, look, I can say, and credit where credit is due, some of these Muslim institutions, some of these scholars, unfortunately, are silent because of the pressures that exist. So I totally understand that these institutions have been set up to push forward the message of Islam, to allow people to pray, allow people to congregate in prayer. But what these institutions must understand, we understand the pressures that they face by the British establishment. But at this current time, it is time that they face these pressures head on, and the communities will stand with them. A lot of, you know, institutions, a lot of masajids, a lot of trusts that have been set up, their answer to not speaking is, we do not want to have our masjids closed down. We do not want to have, you know, external reviews happening on what's happening internally. But I say to each and every single one of them that if now is not the time to face our problems, then when is? If these institutions cannot be the pillars of our community and lead the communities to stand for the Palestinians, then who will? We have so many people within Birmingham who are actually going through PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and this violent situation hasn't even finished yet because of the sheer fact of the, you know, the videos that are coming out, the horrific scenes that we are seeing. If our ulama, if our imams, if our institutions are not going to give direction to the Muslims, who is?
Excellent question. Excellent point, pardon me, that you've made there. If they're not actually going to be doing their job, if they're not going to be leading the Muslim ummah, you know, acts of acting, as you mentioned, in encouraging the good and forbidding the evil is iman, it is faith. And if people are going to be discouraging them from that, people like Mehdi Mudarrisi and Ammar Nakhchiwani, who have in the past diverted people's attention from their support of Palestine, quelling in their rhetoric, in their language, quelling the thirst of the people for change through activism, and even profiting off of this genocide through putting some of their lectures behind a paywall, Sheikh. Like, it beggars belief. What would be your response to this kind of leadership?
Well, you know, I think when leadership abandons its responsibility, that vacuum must be naturally filled. And when I say must be naturally filled, the leadership will come from somewhere else. You see? And this is what we would call maybe revolt or rebellion. So, for example, in this issue of Palestine and what's happening in Gaza, you would find that if, for example, a particular establishment or particular individuals who might be prominent in the society and so forth do not provide the guidance that is necessary to respond to this, which goes back to these three modes, okay? Boycotting means action, the power that we have, you see? When they do not fulfill these three modes, then what happens is you would find the youth, the younger generation, others who see that flaw, you know, who will fill that gap. And this is exactly what is happening with the Gaza issue. You know, not only in the Muslim community, but also in the non-Muslim community, all right? You find that the democratic force of people on the street, you know, results in not only the fall in Joe Biden's approval ratings, but also it results in the fall in the approval ratings of the people we considered to be our leaders, okay, who are also not responding to that.
Because what they're doing is exactly the same.
Exactly.
There's no longer a distinction between the religious and the non-religious leadership because their stances are exactly the same.
Exactly. And this is where now we, or the community who see that gap, you know, need to fill, and this is what is happening.
Okay, well then, in the inverse, what about the scholars who have stepped up? You know, we've got Masalan Sheikh Asrar Rashid, we've got Dr. Abdul Wahid, you know, people like, and I'll come to you, Shaquille, about this question too. But, you know, what about those people? You've got Masalan Sheikh Azhar, Hussein Makki, and all these other, you know, prominent young scholars. What about their example?
Well, I think their example is an example to be followed. I think that they are showing the true leadership in the community, you know, and I think people should be aware of that and should reward them by gathering around them and supporting them, you know, and interacting with them. Mm. Yes, and I don't think, you know, I mean, we're in a time right now where, for example, you have to follow your leaders unquestioningly. This is the 21st century, you know what I mean? There is self-criticism. You know, which is something very important, that, you know, our leaders could come up short in areas, and they should be open to criticism of others in order to improve themselves, just like we as ordinary people as well should do.
And Shaquille, if I can ask you the similar question, you know, what about scholars who have stepped up? What examples do you have of these scholars? Is there a generational gap, it seems? You know, we're seeing that a lot of young scholars, you know, in their 30s who are kind of coming out of these seminaries, they are saying what we believe, what the people can see, whereas older generation of scholars are kind of, you know, more with the establishment, generally.
Yeah, I absolutely have to agree. Namely, Brother Sheikh Asrar Rashid is actually very local to myself. And like the Sheikh in the studio just said, it's the 21st century. So the more younger scholars are actually stepping up because they are basing things on factual evidence. They are actually in touch with their community, they are liaising with their community, and they are being the pillars of society that they need to be. Unfortunately, with some institutions and some individuals, they seem to be more worried about and concerned about protecting their institution when, in fact, they are actually destroying their institution because the communities can see their silence. The communities can see that these people are completely silent on the plight of our people, whether it be the Palestinians, whether it be the Kashmiris, or whether it be any Muslims all over. So I definitely, definitely agree with the Sheikh that in the 21st century, and this is a big, there's a big movement that is taking place. And unfortunately, there will be a time when those people who were silent will be held to account. People will not forget when our blood was being spilled that these people were sat on the sidelines trying to protect their institutions when their institutions were actually set up in the first place to guide the Muslims, to help the Muslims, and moreover, to raise the plight of our people.
You know, Sheikh, what advice now in general to the Muslim public? We're not talking about leaders here, we're talking about everyday men and women. You know, what advice would you give them about their responsibility in forbidding this evil?
First of all, I think when the Muslim, or how should I say, religious elite, put it that way, and their response has to be seen also in a historical context. You know, for example, my brother here was talking about the younger sheikhs. Okay, so it's a generational thing going on here. The first phase of the Muslim community establishing itself in the West is one of, how I would say, nostalgia. Mm. Yeah, you know, I'm from Bangladesh, I come here, I am in an alien environment, I want to feel at home, so I gather with my other fellow Bangladeshis, and we end up building a mosque, which is basically a Bangladeshi religious and community center, you know? And the kind of ulama that they used to invite to come and lead their communities, or people from, let's say, Bangladesh or Pakistan or whatever, being conversant with the language of the environment that you're in was not important. What was important is maintaining your own language, you know, which also meant a certain type of disconnect with the environment that you have. And then the other generation started coming, second generation, third generation, where now their lingua franca is English, where their perspective is one now that is rooted in London or Manchester or Birmingham and what have you. And they require something more. They require now a kind of interfacing between Islam and the environment in which they are. And this is where things fall apart. Mm. Because these older generation people are not in contact and not in touch with their environment and just cannot provide that particular leadership. And so the leadership now tends to sort of want to push towards the younger ulama. At the same time, however, their institutionalized structures tend to sort of put up resistance to this. My advice to the people and the young people and others in this time is to provide, is to fulfill your own leadership, is to take action, you know, and when you are doing this, you will attract the right people to lead you. You see, brave people lead to having brave leaders. Cowardly people tend to have cowardly or maybe even tyrannical leaders. You see, leaders who are not in touch in terms of not being fearless enough to risk sanctions being put on your centers and even probably even the loss of your centers, you know, are not really leaders who are prepared to sacrifice. You see, and as the speakers, as the brother said, what's the name again? Brother Shaquille. You know, my dear brother Shaquille has said, you know, the people end up judging you, and you end up losing the very basis for your support, which ends up with, you know, you have an empty center with nothing
going
on.
I love that. Thank you so much, Sheikh. And thank you, Brother Shaquille, for joining us. And thank you at home. Unfortunately, this is all that we have time for today. Please join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Pentagon says an American warship and multiple U.S. commercial vessels have come under attack in the Red Sea. Also, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken are complicit in Israeli crimes against Palestinians. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Pentagon says an American warship and multiple U.S. commercial vessels have come under attack in the Red Sea, in what is viewed as a major escalation in the strategic waterway over the Israeli regime's brutal onslaught on Gaza. We're aware of reports regarding attacks on USS Carney and commercial vessels in the Red Sea, and will provide information as it becomes available, the Pentagon confirmed on Sunday, 3rd of December. The Pentagon added that USS Carney, which is an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, had shot down missiles and drones aimed at it last week while escorting a commercial vessel in the Red Sea. The American destroyer had been sailing near the Bab el-Mandab Strait, which separates East Africa from the Arabian Peninsula, at the time of last week's attack. But no damage was inflicted on the USS Carney or its crew. The Pentagon fell short of clarifying whether the American warship was struck on Sunday, 3rd of December, and did not identify where it believed the fire came from. The latest attack against the US destroyer and other commercial ships operating in the Red Sea came as Britain's Royal Navy said a suspected drone attack and explosion had been carried out in the area. Ambrey, a UK-based maritime security group, also announced on Sunday, 3rd of December, that a Bahamas-flagged cargo vessel was struck by a rocket while sailing off the western coast of Yemen. Meanwhile, a senior official of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, Osama Hamdan, says the United States administration and its top officials are complicit in Israeli war crimes against Palestinians, including Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Osama Hamdan, a representative of Hamas in Lebanon and also a member of the Hamas movement's political bureau, made the comment in a Sunday, 3rd of December, press conference in Beirut, as Israel pressed ahead with its new round of indiscriminate strikes on Gaza. The Biden administration, President Biden, and his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, are complicit in shedding of Palestinian blood, as well as Israel's massacres of Palestinians and crimes of ethnic cleansing and genocide, and they will pay the price for their crimes, Osama Hamdan stressed. A senior official of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the United States administration's top officials are complicit in Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Hamas official reiterated that despite Israel's brutal aggression and genocidal war against Palestinians of Gaza, the Israeli regime will not achieve any of its goals. What the occupation failed to achieve in more than 50 days before the truce, it will not achieve afterwards either, no matter how long this war continues, Osama Hamdan stressed. Hamdan also referred to an Egyptian and Qatari mediated truce deal that marked a lull in the fighting in Gaza. He stressed that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his army will only reap failure and defeat in their assault on Gaza. Also, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says the United States must bear the consequences of its unbridled support for the Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, made the comment in a joint press conference with his Omani counterpart, Foreign Minister Sayed Badr al-Busseidi, in Tehran on Sunday, 3rd of December. Amir Abdollahian said the new round of Zionist regime attacks on Gaza and the West Bank started after U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin attended the Israeli regime's war cabinet meeting. Amir Abdollahian warned, on the one hand, the United States advises Israel through media to stop massacring women and children and civilians, but in practice it supports and greenlights Israel's genocide in Gaza. The United States must bear the consequences and responsibility for its hypocritical behavior. Amir Abdollahian noted that the Israeli regime has killed nearly 800 women and children in Gaza during the last 2 days alone. We were told by the resistance leaders that if the current situation in Gaza continues, the region will enter a new phase and further spread of war across the region is quite conceivable. Therefore, we warn all warmongers to stop this massacring before it is too late. The Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, added that some of the documents obtained by resistance groups through Operation Al-Aqsa Storm prove that the Israeli regime seeks to expel all inhabitants of Gaza to Egypt and transfer the inhabitants of the West Bank to Jordan. He expressed hope that Egyptian officials would take steps to prevent this Israeli plot from being realized. Bringing the Zionist regime's officials to justice at an international tribunal is a public demand, and lawsuits are being filed by some governments, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, in cooperation with a number of other countries. We hope we would witness the trial of war criminals who have killed nearly 16,000 people in the last 2 months, Hossein Amir Abdollahian emphasized. Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran has never sought insecurity and war in the region. Meanwhile, the Omani foreign minister, al-Busseidi, said he had discussed the latest developments in Palestine and the Israeli attack on civilians in Gaza with his Iranian counterpart. Al-Busseidi said the two foreign ministers stressed the need for continuation of political efforts to bring the war to an end. Al-Busseidi also urged the international community to fulfill its duties towards Palestinians so that security would be restored in the region. America's national broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. military says three commercial ships in the Red Sea were struck by ballistic missiles fired from Houthi-controlled Yemen, and a U.S. warship shot down three drones during the hours-long assault. Ballistic missiles fired by Yemen's Houthi fighters struck three commercial ships on Sunday in the Red Sea, while a U.S. warship shot down three drones during an hours-long assault. The strikes marked an escalation in a series of maritime attacks in the Middle East linked to the Israel-Hamas war, as multiple vessels found themselves in the crosshairs of a single Houthi assault for the first time in the conflict. The United States has vowed to consider all appropriate responses in the wake of the attack. The USS Carney, a U.S. Navy destroyer, detected a ballistic missile fired from Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen at the Bahamas-flagged bulk carrier Unity Explorer. The missile hit near the ship, and the U.S. said shortly afterwards the USS Carney shot down a drone headed its way, although it is not clear if the destroyer was the target of the drone, according to U.S. Central Command. About 30 minutes later, the Unity Explorer was hit by a missile. While responding to its distress call, USS Carney shot down another incoming drone. CENTCOM said the Unity Explorer sustained minor damage from the missile attack. Two other commercial ships, the Panamanian-flagged bulk carriers No. 9 and Sophie 2, were both struck by missiles. The No. 9 reported some damage but no casualties, and the Sophie 2 reported no significant damage, according to U.S. Central Command. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. Yemen's Houthi movement says it has targeted two Israeli ships with an armed drone and a naval missile. The spokesperson for the Yemeni army said two ships, Unity Explorer and No. 9, were targeted after they rejected warnings from the group's navy. British maritime security company Ambrey said a bulk carrier ship had been hit by at least two drones while sailing in the Red Sea. Another container ship reportedly suffered damage from a drone attack about 101 kilometers northwest of the northern Yemeni port of Hodeidah. The Pentagon also said a U.S. warship and multiple commercial ships came under attack in the Red Sea, potentially marking a major escalation in a series of maritime attacks since the Israeli-Hamas war began on 7th of October. The Pentagon said, "We're aware of reports regarding attacks on USS Carney and commercial vessels in the Red Sea and will provide further information as it becomes available."
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. On this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at concerns around police corruption and media freedom. Our special guest is an award-winning journalist who's been at the centre of recent controversy regarding clandestine efforts by both the police and security services in attempts to access his confidential sources. But before we do, let's get a rundown on what seems to be a recurring theme within policing institutions.
In 2014, Theresa May, the then British Home Secretary, commissioned a public inquiry into allegations that undercover police officers had spied on the family of Stephen Lawrence during their campaign to compel police to investigate the racist murder of their son. May called the revelations profoundly shocking and disturbing. Retired Judge Sir John Mitting was appointed to examine the conduct of officers who'd spied on more than 1,000 political groups between 1968 and at least 2010. In June, Mitting's first report was published, arising out of the inquiry's work and what has now become known as the Spy Cop scandal. It also followed revelations that undercover officers were regularly involved in long-term sexual relationships with women during this time. At least four of the undercover officers are known or alleged to have fathered children with women they met during their work. In July this year, more revelations have been uncovered, this time with the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, into allegations that they had obtained the authorisation to access telephone records of journalist Barry McCaffrey after he approached the PSNI's press office in 2013 with questions for a story he was working on about alleged corruption in the police force. McCaffrey was later arrested along with fellow journalist Trevor Burney after a documentary they were both involved in exploring the role of police collusion into the deaths of six civilians in Loughlin Island in 1994 uncovered a cover-up into the killings. These latest allegations once again shine a spotlight into a police force that has been at the centre of a number of controversies since it was reformed and renamed following the Patton Inquiry's recommendations in 2001.
As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's special guest is award-winning journalist Barry McCaffrey. Many of you might remember Barry from the film No Stone Unturned, an explosive expose that shone the spotlight on British state collusion in the massacre of six civilians who were watching the Republic of Ireland play Italy at the World Cup in June 1994. Instead of Barry's investigative work imploring the police to examine the findings and prosecute the suspects, he and fellow journalist Trevor Burney became the focus of police attention. This led to both men being arrested in August 2018, only to be later vindicated and awarded damages. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
Firstly, Barry, how did you become a journalist?
Just by chance, Sean. I had work experience at school. I was lucky enough to end up in the Irish News, and that was 1985. Computers hadn't come in then. It was still typewriters and Tippex and things like that. Then, it's during summer holidays, I would have volunteered for the Irish Times. It used to be in Phantom House in Belfast, and ended up working on building sites in Jersey in the late 80s and early 90s, and eventually came home, was doing a night class just for the headspace to do something, and somebody ended up saying that they were going to do a journalist course, and I just followed them. So it was just always by chance,
Barry, we're going to talk a wee bit about your work on the film No Stone Unturned, but before we do that, we're going to have a wee look at the trailer for the film.
The World Cup Finals. I'd say the biggest day in Irish international soccer history.
Slaughter in Loughlin Island as loyalist terrorists shoot 11 people in the back as they watch the World Cup on television.
And I just remember Mummy saying to us that bad men had come into the pub and they'd shot six people, and Ali was dead.
Did you see anything?
No.
The getaway car was discovered the morning after the attack.
There was just a sense that something wasn't right.
Somebody somewhere helped these people cover this up.
We were thwarted all the time. Every question we asked, we were told, we can't tell you that, that's national security.
They were absolutely ruthless.
I'll never forget their words, we will leave no stone unturned, and those words ring in my ear to this day, because I don't think they've ever left a stone, never mind turned it.
So I was briefed to go down to Belfast and interview several people. What was unusual is that I was told who I could speak to, who I couldn't speak to, what they would be saying, but just as importantly, what they wouldn't be saying.
Certainly the bigger picture was there was this gang in operation and they were involved in serious criminality.
Obviously there was things going on above my head.
The paper trail will lead to the British government and they cannot allow that to happen.
The police were saying the car was destroyed. I thought, hold on,
largest physical exhibit in the case, and you've destroyed it.
10 years with no information. We were kept in the dark.
They knew all along about the dirty war.
You're taking me into an area that I don't really want to go to.
I can't take the risk.
If I can hit somebody early enough and there's a weak one amongst this team, they might start tumbling.
How come they didn't do it?
Good question.
I really do believe
it goes as far
up to the right to the top.
It still gets me every time, Barry, every time I see a trailer or a piece of the film or the film itself, you know, just what the families went through, the victims went through, and, you know, the events that evening were horrendous. But the events leading from that and the way the police didn't investigate still leaves you with more questions than answers, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Especially for the families, you know, nearly 30 years later, they still... the only answers they've got is they found them out themselves, you know, and they've had to drag the RUC and the PSNI, you know, kicking and screaming into courts to try and get any truth whatsoever. And, you know, that quest, that challenge still goes on. You know, the PSNI seem to be more interested in protecting, you know, the man who they say was the killer, rather than giving the families justice.
Mm-hmm. And tell us just a bit more about the film. How did you become involved in the film itself? What happened?
Well, it went back to, so for the first 10 years, from 94 to 2005, the families kept a dignified silence. They didn't do any media. They didn't speak at all, because the police had told them, leave it with us, you know, we will leave no stone unturned, you know, and they put their trust in the police, which you would do in, you know, if you lived in Dublin or London or Glasgow, you trust, it's supposed to be a police service, somebody who serves the public, protects the public. So, like every decent person, the families believed that, you know, the police were their best option. And then in 2005, they realised that they'd been told lies for 10 years. And through Niall Murphy, their solicitor, they agreed to speak for the first time. And they did that through myself with the Irish News. And Niall and the families had tried to do documentaries with the BBC, but the BBC had told them that they weren't interested in legacy cases anymore. And it was just a chance meeting between Trevor and Niall and myself. And Trevor said, well, why don't we do something? That because we were naming the killers or the people who the PSNI said carried out the murders, we were concerned that we would be injuncted, and you know, their identities or the role that they played would never be exposed.
So incredibly, Barry, after all that had been exposed and what had been seen within the film and the expectations that would have been there, you were arrested along with Trevor Burney.
Yes, yeah. Trevor and myself were arrested on the 31st of August 2018. To go back, when the film premiered, we expected a reaction from the PSNI. Probably naively, we expected the PSNI to say, right, we'll look at the allegations in this film, and you know, we'll reopen the investigation, and if we find that they are true, you know, we'll go after the killers. And if it's not, the filmmakers will be discredited. But instead, what they did was they did say that they would reopen the investigation, but it was to find out who our sources were. And that was, you know, that was a scary moment, or you started to realise, This is a bit strange. You're not going after the killers anymore. You're shooting the messenger, and that was so. That led on for a year, and you know, we had our concerns about what would happen, but we never thought that that would we would be arrested. The normal tried and tested method that the relationship between the police and any police force and journalists or filmmakers, if the police believe you have information that they believe could help solve a crime or whatever, they go to court and they look for a production order from a judge, and they go into court and the journalists or the filmmakers go into court and you argue the issue out in front of a judge and a judge decides. And that's the way it should have been. That's the way anywhere else in the world that it happens. But that's not the way it happens here. So on the 31st of August 2018, 7 a.m., so I look down the stairs and I see this blue boiler suit, this figure in a blue boiler suit, at the front door. And it's at that stage you think, right, that's either one or two people. That's either the UVF or the killer coming to shoot us, or it's the police. And you have a decision to make at that stage, do you run back in and hide underneath the bed, or do you let them put the door in, or what do you do? So I decided, I'd just go down the stairs and sort of front it out, whatever it was, and I was sort of delighted when it was a cop at the door, it felt like hugging him. We arrive at Musgrave Street Police Station, and there's two levels to Musgrave Street. There's the ground level was for the shoplifters and, somebody got drunk and made a fool of themselves or whatever, and then the second level, the penthouse, that's the anti-terror suite, that's the Bin Laden suite. And I was hoping we were going down into the shoplifters, but no, we ended up going up in the lift. And then you're stripped, and you've DNA taken, your fingerprints and all of that. And then you're putting your shoes are off, and you're putting the cell or whatever. And then you have a wee cry to yourself, You get in underneath the blanket, and you just, all you want is your mummy. And that went on. Shocking at that stage to see that they were there. The main prosecution witness against us was the man who they say killed six people. And that's how perverse the PSNI, the investigation was. They weren't trying to find, they weren't trying to find justice for the Loughran Island families. They were using the killer against us to try and, to try and shut us up.
Mental. It just illustrates very clearly how dysfunctional this place is, doesn't it? But you've also then, Barry, because it just doesn't end there, and the raid and the arrest and all the rest of it. You've recently been at the centre of a police spying scandal where the Investigative Powers Tribunal set up to investigate complaints against the intelligence services and public authorities have uncovered a further case going back to 2013.
So we initially thought that it was going to be about Loughran Island. That's, that's what we were really interested in. But the IPT came back and said, no, sorry, you were spied on actually 5 years earlier in 2013. And we're going to investigate this case or this incident first before we get to Loughran Island. And it was only by cross-referencing the dates that we realised what the case was about, because they don't tell you what you were being spied on. And it was only through sheer luck that when I cross-referenced the dates, I realised that actually what it was a story that I was doing about police corruption.
You're still tuned in to The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildenew, alongside our special guest, investigative journalist, Barry McCaffrey.
Thank you, Sean.
So obviously all of that is going to have an impact on public confidence in the PSNI. Do you think that extends to academia or trade unions or other professions as well?
I have no doubt that what has happened to Trevor and myself, we're just the tip of the iceberg. We have met with a broad range of people from academia, NGOs, and right across society. And what has been most alarming is that this isn't a one-off. We have no doubt it's happening to journalists. They're spying not only on journalists, but we met one person who was a member of the policing board, who was a civilian member of the policing board, and they were able to tell us that the exact same thing had happened to them. The chief constable needs to front up now and tell us, you know, this isn't Stasi Germany. It's not supposed to be Stasi Germany. A police service is supposed to serve the public. They're not supposed to spy on, especially people who are only doing their job. Journalists, we are entrusted by society to hold government and government agencies to account. Journalism isn't a crime.
Mm-hmm. And how damaging overall do you think this has been to public confidence?
I think this is just the latest in a long line of, you know, self-inflicted mistakes that the PSNI have committed on themselves. How is society supposed to have confidence in policing when we now know that police are, why, you know, what have the PSNI to hide? Why are they spying on us? Why didn't they come out and say, sorry, there's an allegation of police corruption and we're investigating it? Mm-hmm. Why did they, and why are they still trying to hide through these secret courts?
Yeah, Barry, I suppose many of us grew up with police and army raids on our homes in the 70s and 80s, but the ones post Good Friday Agreement were nearly worse because it was a different environment in which they were happening. But that raid on you and your family was a terrible ordeal. You know, what impact did it have?
It's like a boomerang. It keeps on coming back. You know, so you have to, I'd be very open about, I have challenges with mental health or whatever. So you have to talk to people. You have to cope with it. Some people just, you can compartmentalize it and, put it away. And it takes a heavy toll.
And after all that's happened, Murray, how do you view, do you still have confidence in the police?
We have to bring this thing right to the very end to defend press freedom. Because if we don't fight it to the last, stretch, they'll do this again and again. We have to make sure that what they have done never happens again. Mm-hmm. Because if they're not, and the only way we can do that is if they are held to account. So they can't have these secret hearings and, closed-door hearings that we don't get into, that our solicitors don't get into. The PSNI can tell whatever lies they want in there, and nobody's there to challenge it because we're not allowed in. If we are going to restore confidence in policing, it has to be open and it has to be transparent. And the PSNI have to come out and say, sorry, we spied on, so many, whether it's journalists, NGOs, politicians, ordinary people in the street. You know, that's what the Stasi had to do. The files were opened. That's what, so if the PSNI have files on every member in society that they shouldn't have, if they have been spying on the people in society, well, let's open the files. It was good enough for Germany. It was good enough for South Africa. But the home of democracy, British democracy. If this is a democratic society, let's open the files. Because if they have done nothing wrong, they have nothing to fear of. That's the thing. Either they have done wrong or they haven't done wrong. And if they haven't done something wrong, let's have it open in court.
Well, Barry, listen, I want to thank you for coming in again. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Michelle.
We want to wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. This week, we took us to Dublin to have a look at the Moore Street campaign, where a small number of activists have been challenging the Irish government to maintain the cultural integrity of an area described by the National Museum of Ireland as the most important site in modern Irish history.
In April 1916, the course of Irish history changed forever. In a rebellion that witnessed hundreds of armed revolutionaries take on the might of the British Empire, a call for a national right to freedom and sovereignty was read out by one of the leaders of the rising, Padraig Pearse, as he stood with an armed guard on the steps of the GPO in Dublin. After a number of days of pitch